everyone, and welcome to Risky Business episode 202. I am Patrick Gray. This week's edition of the show is brought to you by Astaro. And Astaro founder, co-founder, Marcus Hennig will join us later for a chat about Sony's curious statement a couple of weeks ago that its brand is recovering already from all of the negativity surrounding its security woes. Does that ring true to him? Does it ring true to you? Let's find out soon. Now, this week's show, we're just going to do news and a sponsor interview because we have got so much news to get through this week. It's absolutely silly. So, yeah, instead of a feature, you're going to get a nice big double half-hour dose of Adam Bylow, who's joining us right now for a look at the week's news headlines. And Adam, it's been another huge week of news on the security beat with a number of breaches and all sorts of data being dumped in all sorts of places. And in fact, we're gonna have to actually wrap that all up towards the end of the week's news segment because, you know, we've actually got a lot of other stuff to get through. And I suppose the number one item this week is that Wired News has actually released all of the Manning Lamo chat logs that led to Manning's arrest.
Yeah, it's interesting that they have actually now finally dropped them. They're claiming that the reasons that they previously hadn't chosen to release them, which was mostly about respecting Manning's privacy and, you know, some of the more personal stuff that was in there, they've now decided that enough of that's already in the public domain that there's no real reason not to publish them. And they've gone ahead and done so. And I guess, you know, well, interesting to see whether the people who were leveling criticism at Wired earlier on now, you know, rummage through and find something worth all the criticism, or whether it is actually, you know, just the usual sort of crap you would get from a messed up kid, you know, stuck in a war zone.
Yeah, well, I mean, guys like Glenn Greenwald, who's like a blogger for Salon.com, you know, he was sort of leading the charge, making all sorts of allegations against Wired and saying that they acted unethically. They even sort of said stuff about Kevin Paulson being an FBI plant and all of this ridiculous stuff, especially if you know Kevin. It's just, you know, you couldn't actually say anything more funny. I mean, your initial reaction is to laugh, and then you realize that they're making some pretty heavy allegations about someone who's, you know, worked very hard to establish themselves as a professional in the media industry, and indeed is someone I respect as a journalist. And really, Wired was never under any obligation to release this material. It's their own source material, and it's theirs to do whatever the hell they want with. I guess the rationale now is that because Manning's a public figure and because the whole thing is, you know, such a big story, that, you know, that document belongs in the public domain, and that's the decision they've taken. So anyone who wants to can now go to Wired.com and read those logs.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's good to have this kind of raw material available, you know, first-hand material available for us out in the, you know, in the public to, you know, form our own opinions about exactly what happened.
Indeed, indeed. In this next piece, now this is one that we actually covered a while ago. There was a bloke who was basically hijacking his next-door neighbor's Wi-Fi and messing with him and, you know, sending death threats to, like, the vice president from the dude's computer so that, you know, he got raided and stuff. And he was just really making his neighbor's life hell. He's been sentenced to 18 years in prison.
Yeah, and I have to admit, I was a little surprised. I mean, clearly this dude is a bit of a knobhead, right? And the things he was doing were, you know, pretty vindictive and, you know, clearly something that does deserve some punishment. Although 18 years in jail does seem like quite a lot. You know, you'd imagine that there are murderers who get less than that. It's kind of a sad story all around. This guy, you know, what, bust the web in his neighbor's crypto after, I think they told the police that they thought maybe he was a pedophile. You know, maybe they had reason, maybe they didn't, I don't know. But anyway, so he went ahead and hacked into the network via their crappy web crypto. Apparently it took him 2 weeks. I don't know what the hell he was doing, you know, for the 13 days up to the point.
He got 18 years for failing to crack web within, you know,
within a reasonable time frame. It's like, yeah, 20 minutes to an hour, dude, otherwise you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, so then he bust in and you know, made a MySpace page in the name of the guy with, you know, kiddie porn on it or some shit like that. I mean, it doesn't sound like a particularly smooth operation, and clearly the dude, you know, was a you know, knob end.
Yeah, he's a bit of a bell end, this bloke, and he's gone away. I mean, he was trying to frame them for kiddie porn offences and stuff, and it was the fact that that the neighbours themselves had reported him to police, alleging that he'd kissed their four-year-old son on the lip. So, you know, this is one of those neighbourly disputes that just went absolutely berserk. Interestingly enough, he actually turned down a 2-year plea agreement last year to charges relating to the threatening email that was sent to Joe Biden, the American vice president. But after that, apparently, the authorities just added a whole bunch more charges, including identity theft and all sorts of things. So, yeah, he actually wound up pleading guilty to them last year. And, 18 years in the pound me in the ass.
Yeah, it was interesting that apparently he had done it previously to a different neighbor somewhere else who had, you know, parked in his driveway or something. So, you know, maybe it is a good thing he's in jail after all.
Yeah, well, have fun in prison.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Now, Wired.com, I mean, obviously this is a mega feature that we're not going to be able to cover off, but I just wanted to mention that Wired.com has an excellent piece written by their writer, Kim Zeta, all about Stuxnet. It seems to be the most comprehensive feature written on that particular malware. Definitely worth a read, and I know that you've read it and you enjoyed it yourself.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good write-up of, you know, the whole set of issues from start to finish, and touches on, you know, the technical bits and the, you know, the specific details, but also goes into a lot of information about, you know, sort of the political aspects and interviews with a bunch of the guys who reversed it at Symantec. And Symantec certainly come out of this looking like they really did, you know, contribute something pretty valuable here. But yeah, it's a great write-up, and if you've been following Stuxnet, it's well worth the, you know, 15, 20 minutes of your life to read it.
Yeah, it's funny too, because we really love hanging shit on big companies like Symantec, and then you read something like this and you're like, wow, you guys actually do have really good researchers doing really interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, being a company the size of Symantec, you know, having those dudes spend, you know, a month or two of their work, you know, reversing something like this, that they can actually afford that, and it's great that they were able to do that and do so without any pressure. Well, certainly they didn't acknowledge any pressure from outside to either not report it about it or to not do the research. And I think, you know, that's really good.
Yeah.
Yay, Symantec.
That piece is called How Digital Detectives Deciphered Stuxnet. So go forth to your Googles and find it. On to this next piece now. And apparently, look, more malware is starting to attack Android. It seems like the primary vector for infection is through, you know, sort of Trojan apps on various app stores. But, you know, you've really got to wonder how long it's going to take until people start using sort of drive-by browser exploits to hose these sorts of devices. And of particular concern is the fact that one of these Trojans looks like it's designed to intercept one-time passwords via SMS. So it's sort of ties in with Zeus. It's looking like a really nasty banking Trojan.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the way that Android malware so far has been spreading, which is primarily through repackaged apps in, you know, in non-core app stores. But we have seen a few turn up in the main app store. But yeah, it's not a particularly sophisticated way to go about dropping these things. And when we see things like the jailbreak we talked about last week on the latest iOS, you know, yeah, as you say, how long till we start seeing real proper techniques for dropping, you know, drive-by dropping malware on Android devices? You know, I don't know how soon that will turn up, but it's probably going to happen. Although really, it's interesting that this app store, actually, are we allowed to call it an app store? Did Apple sue everybody yet?
Yeah, probably. I don't think we're technically allowed to call this a podcast, actually.
it's kind of funny that, you know, we've seen this method last so long because it really is a natural side effect of Google's openness on their marketplace. But I don't know what they're going to do about it other than start to close them up a bit if we used to these turn up, you know, on the core app store more often.
Yeah, but the fact is the Trojans are developed now, and if they close off that infection vector, they're just going to use another one. You know, there is a knowledge base there. There is source written. There are binaries compiled. And there are known exploits that function on a fairly substantial proportion of Android devices because they're so difficult to patch. So I think really the prediction that this is going to, you know, turn into a substantial problem, I think that's going to bear out.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And certainly the difficulties in patching the Android ecosystem is something we've talked about before as well, and that's only going to compound it. You know, maybe everyone's just sitting on their Android remotes waiting until they actually need to use them. I guess that's what I would do.
Well, you don't need to, man. I mean, the Immunity guys released a couple of browser exploits that have worked just fine, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you don't need O-Day with them. You need bloody, you know, 200-Day. It's going to work just fine. Now, a topic that we have covered on Risky Business probably over the last 18 months or so has been various governments' attempts to persuade the manufacturers of online communication software like Skype, you know, Google, Facebook, you know, organizations like that, to persuade them to allow some sort of mechanism for communications interceptions. Obviously, they were targeting BlackBerry first. That was a very big issue. It seems now that India's security agencies, especially in the light of recent terrorist activity in their country, they are really pushing quite hard for Skype and Google to offer, you know, lawful interception capabilities to law enforcement. And I mean, the pressure's not going away, and you've got to expect that these companies at some point are going to capitulate.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because people like Skype and Google, right, I guess, don't have the same technical legacy that BlackBerry of having built end-to-end crypto in from the beginning. Mm. They have a much more flexibility about how they deploy things. And so they don't have the same fallback position that RIM did, which is, well, what do you expect us to do? You know, crypto made it so that we can't let you intercept this stuff. Like, what do you expect us to do? Factor prime numbers? Mm. Whereas, you know, Google and Skype, don't really have that. And then they have them also because it's not their core business in the same way that it is with RIM. They don't really have quite the same amount of leverage, I guess. At least with RIM, they can turn around and say, well, all the businessmen in India are going to be real fucking pissed if you turn off their phones. Whereas, you know, Gmail and Skype is somewhat less entrenched with such a powerful audience. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the, you know, in the medium term, because as you say, it is an issue that isn't going to go away. And governments, I guess, are used to having the intercept capabilities that they did on the PSTN and the cell nets. And, you know, they're going I wanted everywhere else.
It's always a really interesting discussion that the right to privacy from the state, I personally don't think is assumed, because there are some pretty shady people out there doing some pretty shady shit. So the idea is that you have really good checks and balances and only allow court-appointed warrants and things like that, and just have really good oversight. But I can't say that as a principle that law enforcement and intelligence agencies shouldn't be able to intercept those types of communications, because there is a benefit to us in those communications being intercepted if that process is managed properly and people's, you know, and innocent people don't wind up being caught up in that stuff. I think the key here is judicial oversight.
Yeah, and I to a certain extent I agree with you. And for me, as a, you know, as a technologist, I suppose the real interesting thing here is kind of less whether or not we as a society want to, but more how we deal with the technology that we're building, preventing it from being possible. I mean, if you deploy crypto, right, it's just not feasible.
Yeah, but no one deploys
how much
crypto,
you want
right?
to or deserve. Well, I mean, it is plausible. Like, I mean, Phil Zimmerman's Z phone stuff, right? If that was built into handsets, or, you know, there was some way that you could do that without, download an app and use it easily on your phone. And that started picking up in a widespread manner. Like, how do we as a society who has accepted that we might want to be able to intercept communications, how do we deal with, you know, it not just not being possible, as opposed to being something desirable and difficult, but, you know.
Yeah, it's that whole doable. It's the whole whack-a-mole thing, isn't it? You know, you just sort of wonder if there is an interception capability there, will people accept it, or will it be enough of an issue for people to move away from Skype to some sort of competing technology? But it's an issue, as I say, that is still dragging on, and an interesting one, and we'll just, you know, keep an eye on it, as we all do, as we always do.
Well, they're keeping an eye on us, right?
Yeah, well, they're trying. So this one's written by our buddy Liam Tung, but apparently support for Windows XP is supposed to end in 1,000 days, which sounds probably a little bit sooner than it is. It's a few years. But when you consider that XP still has something like 51% market share, we're looking down the barrel of a potential problem here.
Well, I mean, yeah, exactly. The fact that Vista wasn't taken up and people are only really starting to push 7 out now, right? I mean, the deadline's what, April 2014, right? That's not far away in enterprise timeframes. I mean, you know, it takes you, if you have a project, right, to go and move off XP, right, it'll take you a year of planning to start the project, plus a year of project management, then maybe a year of rollout. Right? There's your 3 years gone. So, I mean, I think, you know, we will still see a very significant installed base of XP in 2014, and it will be a big problem. I mean, it's a problem that, you know, I still see Win2K boxes around. Hell, I even saw a Win NT4 box in production, you know, in the last year.
Well, I mean, I still hear of people seeing them running as VMware images, you know, like here and there as well. Like NT4 legacy apps haven't gone away. They're still around.
Well, exactly, yeah. And I mean, Win2K is much the same. I've seen real hardware Win2K boxes as well as VMs. But yeah, XP is going to be around for a while. And you know, I guess to Microsoft's credit, right, they have pushed out the support window for XP, and I really, you know, feel some real pity for the poor engineers at Microsoft that are responsible for backporting all the crazy fixes to XP to make them work. That's got to be a pretty thankless job.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they're going to have to push out this window because it's just it is coming up, and you know, it really does have potential to become a massive issue if all of a sudden, you know, say the market share is down to 20%, that's still an awful lot of machines that are going to be marooned, you know, and left unsupported.
Well, on the other hand, right, they've pretty much end-of-life IE6, and I mean, what percentage of people are still using that, you know?
I don't know, actually.
A bunch, right? Well, I mean, certainly a lot of corporates I see are still running IE6 because of all the, you know, first-gen, you know, Ajaxy, RAA-style web apps were all built to be IE-only, and, you know, everyone internally is still running that shit.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of IE6 around still, and I mean, that's getting people on left, right, and center.
Well, I guess maybe we just have to hope that the Mayan calendar is right.
Well, yeah, that would certainly solve a lot of our problems if we all, you know, hurry up and die next year.
Yeah, if we die in a massive sort of planetary fireball, I don't think the XP thing's going to be such a big deal. But moving on. Oh, another Microsoft story here. This is a bit of a lull. Microsoft Security Center wound up being like SEO poisoned or something.
Yeah, I didn't actually follow the exact details, but yeah, some sneaky SEO guys managed to, what, like poison the results to return porn and stuff, and then Microsoft Security Center search, which is pretty funny, really.
It's a little bit embarrassing. I suppose the good part, the less embarrassing part for Microsoft, is that the flaw was actually closed within a few hours of it being reported. So probably a few red faces over at Microsoft HQ there.
Yeah, it's certainly not the stupidest thing we're going to cover a corporate doing this week.
No, it's not. That's coming up in a little moment. Now, of course, over the last couple of weeks, Google has been rolling out its competition, its competing service to Facebook. It's called Google Plus. And there's been a little bit of a snag or a little bit of a technical glitch, I suppose. It's a victim of its own success because somehow it ran out of disk space or something. The service ran out of disk space. And this caused some sort of spamming glitch.
Yeah, apparently there's one of the mechanisms in Google Plus spams you out notifications about something. And the box that stores, I guess, who has been notified about what, ran out of disk. And the net result appeared to be that their email outs were not marked as having successfully completed. And as a result, they went around and spammed a whole bunch of people. Some people were saying they were receiving, what, the same messages 12 or so times. So, I mean, I guess, you know, in terms of problems that you could have, you know, your service being so popular that it runs out of disk, yeah, not so bad.
Not so bad. Also, not the dumbest thing we've seen a corporate do this week.
Really not.
Now, the dumbest thing that we have seen a corporate do this week. Now, this is a real drum roll. I mean, I'm going to probably have to dig up a drum roll for this one. I mean, this is
definitely
incredible. Drum roll, please. Adam.
Oh, man. So, our good chums over at Sony. And you know this is going to be bad when Sony's involved. Our good chums over at Sony apparently decided that they needed a captcha on one of their websites, you know, to stop pesky automated, you know, browsers filling in their forms instead of actual humans. So the conventional wisdom is you issue the user with a challenge that is easy for a human to solve and, hard for a machine, right? That's normally how you do it. And apparently Sony's, you know, engineering team or research team, or, you know, their Skunk Labs came up with this this very, very hip, very now, very Web 2.0 idea in which you you put the capture code into the HTML page and then you use client-side CSS and JavaScript to munge it up so you can't look at it, thus saving the load of the server, you know, for generating the capture image. And then the user reads it, fills it in, submits the... Hang on, wait, what?
Brilliant, isn't it? Isn't it just brilliant? I mean, doesn't a story like this... I mean, it's just... You really wonder, don't you? You just really, you really wonder. You're like, someone had to actually sit down and do this. And then someone probably had to sign off on it, and then it went into production. This is... I mean, it's just... I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I really don't. I think I'm going to go with laugh.
I'm very much in the laughing category. It's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah,
I mean, no. I've seen some bad captures. Lots of people do captures badly, but this is pretty creative. I mean, you know, distorting the image, you know, distorting the character's client side in JavaScript. Right, that's pretty special.
And someone would have had to develop that. You know, that's the crazy thing. You know,
pick recapture off the shelf and plug it in. Done. No. Develop your own solution. Test it across all the browsers.
Yeah.
You know, yeah,
and actually view them. Or is it distorted enough? Can a person still read it? You know, it's like, what the f-? Have they actually fixed it yet? Do we know? Or is it still out there?
I have no idea.
Oh, God. That was a good one, mate. Thank you for finding that one because it didn't actually pop up on the regular sites. I'm sure now that we've talked about it on the podcast, it's probably going to find its way into some of the tech sites. But what a brilliant one. I think that came from a site called geek.com. Is that right?
Actually, I picked it up. Someone pasted the link, I think, in IRC, but it was some guy's post on a Google Plus page, actually.
Oh, nice. And are we sure that it's legit?
Did we confirm Yeah, there were people posting details of it. Someone posted like a one-liner with wget that'll pull out the raw capture for you.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Just to help automate your spams. Or your account brute forces or whatever it was designed to protect. Anyway, we're going to have to fly through the last little bit of news because we are running out of time. Apparently, a bunch of low-hanging anon fruit was busted in Italy and Switzerland.
Yeah, really, kids, if you're going to run LOIC and DOS shit, like, don't do it from your home tubes, really.
Yeah. Enough said.
Yeah.
Morgan Stanley managed to lose 34,000 customer records on unencrypted CDs. It doesn't look like those CDs were stolen. It just looks like they got lost, but they were unencrypted. Naughty Morgan Stanley.
Exactly. Naughty, you should crypto stuff. And it's good that actually this does get reported. You know, it's nice that we see a couple of them, but if only every time someone lost a CD full of information, it got reported.
Yeah, well, we'd be talking about nothing but, I suspect.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, bad Morgan Stanley, but seriously, bad everybody else who's ever lost anything. Which is, I guess, everybody, right?
Now, readers of Rupert Murdoch's Melbourne-based tabloid, The Herald Sun, also affectionately known as The Hun, or The Herald Scum, I mean, they were living up to their name by actually serving up malware on their website for a short time. Nothing really groundbreaking in this story. It's just nice pointing out because, you know, I personally have a rather strong dislike for that newspaper.
Yeah. Was there any details about exactly like had they got owned and people were doing it? Was it cross-site scripted in, or was it the third party ad network as we've usually seen?
They were a little bit slim on it. They were a little bit slim on details, but they were just like, yeah, we were serving up malware, our bad, sorry, roll.
Dicks. Well, moral story is don't serve up malware on your site and then you won't have to apologize for it.
There you go. But it happens, doesn't it? Because there's so many ways to skin that particular cat.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the ad networks are probably the worst culprit, but I mean, show me a news site that you can't cross-site script your own stories into.
Shh.
That's a real free
Shut
press.
Up.
Anyway.
Well, technically, risky.biz is a blog. anyway, now look, there's been so many breaches and so much sort of, you know, Anon-style info leaks and hacking that we're just really going to have to do. I think we're going to have to push this into a weekly segment of its own. In this weekly breach wrap-up, Germany's police service actually got owned and a whole bunch of data relating to the tracking of suspects was stolen. That seems pretty heavy. It was a left-wing hacking group called the No Name Crew. And pretty bad. They got in via the country's customs service, I think.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't look good. This is the same dudes who dropped the details on the neo-Nazis that we were making fun of a few weeks ago now. So it's good that they're they're carrying on, and we are seeing some interesting politicized hacking going on. But yeah, this is obviously not a good look for the German feds.
And I must say, risky.biz got an angry email from a listener who was most upset with our coverage of the Nazi hack and the publication of data relating to Nazi party memberships, because as they quite rightly pointed out, people who were on that list, you know, they might have used old addresses, they might have signed up people who weren't actually Nazis to be on that list and stuff. And so, you know, it was terrible that we were encouraging that sort of vigilantism. So, you know.
Won't somebody think of the Nazis?
Oh, QQ for the Nazis. but yeah, fair point. We do not encourage vigilantism. We do not encourage it. But it's kind of funny. Sometimes.
Lol sex, not funny. It's all very serious business.
There are no lols with lol sex. None. Now, in another breach, Toshiba got owned and a whole bunch of stuff got paste binned, including like reseller accounts and customer details, stuff like that.
Yeah, it was a pretty small breach in terms of numbers. What, they were like, what, 450 customers? But I mean, yeah, any breach is pretty shit when you're the customer whose info is being dropped there.
Well, whoever did it, they were calling themselves Void, said they were Scandinavian, and said that the entire stolen database contained something like 10,000 usernames, email addresses, and street addresses, passwords, and phone numbers. But they just dumped some of them by the looks of things. Now, obviously, the biggest one over the last week was the apparent exposure of data stolen from Booz Allen Hamilton, the United States-based defense contractor. This was a big deal. Apparently, 90,000 military email addresses got dumped.
Yeah, this was an interesting thing. And we've been, I guess, expecting to see, you know, attacks against the likes of Halliburton and Booz Allen Hamilton and the rest of the mill industrial sort of complex. But yeah, this is embarrassing. And obviously, you know, password reuse in other military sites is something that we would be pretty worried about. I had a quick look through the data. I think there were two dudes from nzdf.mil.nz.
Hi, guys.
Who are in the list, and I'm sure they're out changing their passwords as we speak. But yeah, this is not a good look. And I think Booz Allen Hamilton didn't really acknowledge it publicly yet, but you know, it certainly looked pretty legit to me.
Yeah, they say we don't comment on this sort of stuff and blah blah blah. But 90,000 email addresses, including password hashes, which are non-salted MD5, so they are entirely crackable. So this is, you know, this is a big deal. I think also that it should be said that I think whoever did this, and it is anti-sec, whoever did this, I think really did them a favor, because it is ridiculous to think that this information that they obtained was not already in the possession of perhaps some actors who wished to do more harm to the United States than anti-sec do.
Well, yeah, and this was a good point about the whole, you know, the whole LSEC anti thing, is every box that they drop publicly and every piece of data they drop publicly is one less piece of data that's in the hands of real black hats who are, you know, keeping it secret, the fact that they have owned people. So, yeah, I mean, in that respect, yeah, I agree with you. It's a very good thing.
Securing the internets through lulls.
Through lulls and pastebin.
There you go. Anonymous apparently took down Monsanto. Monsanto actually has released a statement since then saying that the data released was publicly available data, which we'd also seen in the case of the data that they obtained from the Australian Electoral Commission, which was a whole bunch of XML, which is publicly available anyway. So we're seeing some pretty silly leaks here. But I suppose what's interesting too is in this article, which is written by Eleanor Mills, she outlines plans by Anonymous to actually attack a bunch of oil companies who are planning on embarking on a somewhat controversial project pertaining to the mining of tar sands in Canada and, you know, stuff that has a potential environmental impact. So it seems that this stuff is becoming more and more politically charged, and it's starting to be refined a little bit into more specific targets.
Yeah, so this is Anonymous Project Tarmageddon, apparently. It was, you know, a catchy name. They've got that bit right. I guess the real fear is, you know, these companies who are, you know, who are becoming very much targets, like, what are they going to do when groups like Anonymous or, you know, even groups like, I guess, Greenpeace or some of the more radical radical groups, when they actually do get real hacking skills, you know, when they get someone who really does know what they're doing, then, you know, I really wouldn't want to be the security guys at ExxonMobil or Imperial Oil or anyone else who's on the target list, right? Because, you know, if you're a big company and someone wants to get in, they're going to get in.
Well, Adam, that's it for this week's Monster News segment. Thanks for joining us, mate, and we'll chat to you again soon.
And we'll talk to you next week, Pat.
Adam Boileau of New Zealand's Insomnia Security there, and Insomnia Security, of course, is Brett Moore's business. Brett is a very well-respected guy over there in NZ, and yeah, really, if you're a New Zealand-based company and, you know, you're assigning work about the place, you've got absolutely no excuse to not have these guys on your list. They're absolutely top-notch, so thanks also to Brett for allowing Adam to be silly and waste his time chatting with me on the show. Up next, it's time for this week's sponsor interview, and this week's show is brought to you by the fine folk at Astaro, makers of fine UTM devices. Astaro has, of course, been acquired by Sophos, which is great news for our next guest, Astaro co-founder Marcus Hennig. Marcus joins the show now to discuss a CNET article I spotted a couple of weeks ago. The piece describes Sony CEO Howard Stringer's claim at a shareholders meeting that the company's brand perception is, quote, clearly improving again. Stringer says 90% of PSN users have come back to the service, and the company's online services will be a growth engine for Sony into the future. Well, is he dreaming? Marcus Hennig.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised to read this, that they already thought that their brand is clearly improving again, I cannot really agree with it, and I'm somehow wondering from where they know that their brand already improved. I'm not a brand expert for myself, but it's obvious that it will take much more time than to improve and to reestablish a brand than it will take to destroy it. So I see a serious problem that Sony as a brand and Sony as a term is more or less the same word for constant hacking attacks, which are successful not because these hacking attacks are sophisticated, but because it looks like that Sony is an easy target. So I think there is a much bigger damage than you can imagine, or the people on the board sitting together with their shareholders can imagine.
Yeah, well, it's funny here because the chief executive of Sony, Howard Stringer, you know, it was all very upbeat according to this piece that CNET ran, and he pointed out that 90% of Sony's PlayStation Network users have actually come back to the service. Now, first of all, that tells me a couple of things. That tells me that 10% haven't come back, which seems to be a fairly large percentage just to lose because of a very apparently an easy sort of trivial attack. And it also tells us that they're kind of missing the point, because don't you think it might change, you know, the people's decision when they go to buy their next console? Maybe it's really going to hurt them more longer term?
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. And that 90% came back to their network. Yeah, what is the alternative for these people? They cannot change to a different network with their PlayStation. There is only one network for playing online with their PlayStation. So they have to go to the Sony network. But maybe that's exactly how I say that's a long-term thing. If the decision is up for another PlayStation or for next generation, maybe they will think twice if they again buy a Sony one, or if they maybe go with an other vendor. And there are some more else, yeah.
One thing that I also wonder about is where the damage to the brand was inflicted. Now, I'd really like to believe that the damage to the brand was inflicted through all of these attacks that showed that they weren't operating particularly secure networks, and they were being somewhat, it appears that they were being somewhat careless with their customers' data. But honestly, the reason that I believe there was brand damage and they were dragged through the headlines to such an extent is because the PlayStation Network actually went down. It seems to me that people don't really care so much about their personal information being breached, but they care when they load up their PlayStation and they can't get online to play games. Do you think I'm being too cynical, or do you think there's an element of truth in that?
I think there's an element of truth, and the truth is maybe that not all of this million of people, they have an account on the on this PlayStation Online network, even are aware that their personal data, including their credit card details, got hacked and get lost. So maybe people heard about it, but to be quite frankly, there's every day a new data breach somewhere in the news, and nobody shows really up and listen up who is affected, and wondering if the people itself have an account there and maybe also then involved into this. So I would expect that not all of them are really aware of it. And additionally, maybe they wonder what will happen then and think, yep, it's maybe just my credit card data, and I can easily dispute then anything which was booked on my credit card, because just pointing that I'm a Sony PlayStation Network user, and therefore I'm fine. It's more a problem of my credit card company and Sony itself. So maybe therefore people staying relaxed, or it looks like that they're staying relaxed. So maybe the bigger problem is then on the side of the payment card industry.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, isn't it? Because consumers, it seems, in the CIA model, the confidentiality, integrity, and availability model, it seems that the only real thing that consumers seem to give a shit about is the availability factor. When it comes to confidentiality, it's only the most personal of information that they seem to care about, things that they're putting on Facebook, medical records, things like that. But they're sort of you know, less sensitive data. They just really don't seem to care. But it's difficult to argue that they should, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not really sure about this. Maybe it appears so, because where do you get, where do we have the chance to talk to millions of these people using the PlayStation Network? They have no voice in the press, in the news, where they can stand up and demonstrate or shouting that they are completely pissed because their data get lost. So the majority can't be heard from the public. So therefore, I'm not really sure if because they are not in the news and there is no such kind of an PlayStation Network user union which can speak up for all of them and start a lawsuit against Sony or so, that they're not really take care of. And then there also maybe is a slowly but constant changing mindset that people, because of this constant news coverage of data breach and data loss, get aware of what with their private data happens, and then not this relaxed as, let's say, begin of the century, people were with their private data and everybody had this private homepage and set up everything he knows and picture and personal data, as a lot of people still do on Facebook. But I think I can, from my private observation, monitoring and mindset change, that people are aware that there is private data and that there's a big industry trying to get it and to deal with it. And they're thinking about it at least.
Yeah, well, that is a positive development. And that sort of leads me to my next line of questioning, which is, you know, when we look at all of the stuff that's happened recently with Anonymous and Lulzsec and all of these guys inflicting damage on large corporations, and indeed even doing something like a distributed denial of service attack against the Central Intelligence Agency and stealing data from FBI-affiliated websites, even though you and I both know that doing a denial of service attack against a website is a fairly trivial thing, do you think news headlines that point to these sorts of activities are undermining the general confidence that the average person has in the internet and the security of the internet? And do you think that's a good thing? Because I think it's a good thing to have that confidence undermined. People are too confident.
The good thing is that it's publicly shown that even large companies, large names, brands, organizations, even governmental institutions are vulnerable, and that there is no 100% protection, and there is not just because of the name and of the size, that it's worth to have confidence just because of this. Confidence need to be established because of technology in place and proven mechanisms which prevent that data get lost. But unfortunately, these good and this example exists, but these good examples are not in the press and has no media coverage because it's somehow uninteresting to report that this XYZ company never lost customer data until now. So only the bad examples in the news, and therefore maybe also implying and somehow not really right picture.
Well, I think we could get to the point where we're going to start doing news stories about companies that don't lose data, because it seems all of them are. I guess what I was getting at before is you mentioned the mechanisms, you know, proven mechanisms that can prevent data from going missing. You made a very interesting point there too, that the general population seem to believe that if there's a big institution that's under attack or a big brand name that's under attack, whether it's government or private sector, that if they're an established brand, they're somehow less vulnerable. So it really is changing that perception, isn't it? That just because you're big, it doesn't mean that you're invulnerable to this stuff. In fact, quite the opposite, because you're more of a target.
Yeah, exactly. One point is you're more of a target. You are interesting because also just because of the amount of data available or maybe available on these big enterprises, organizations. And secondly, the surface these kind of companies and organizations have to the internet is much bigger So they are much more vulnerable. They have more than one web server, and they have more than one database. They have distributed all over the world. And exactly in the case of Sony, because it was constantly since months where data leakage was reported, I got more or less to the impression even people within Sony had no clue what kind of services and installations they even run themselves. And they just discovered, because they were successfully attacked, that there is an additional machine running to the outside, to the internet, which was vulnerable and which was hosting customer data.
It reminds me actually of a story from several years ago. I think it was around 2001, 2002, that a Linux machine was actually discovered in a port scan at a university. I think it was at a university. And they found this Linux box with crazy uptime, you know, and then they tried to physically locate it and they couldn't. And it turned out that it had actually been plastered inside a wall. And they had to like get an axe to get to physically get to this machine. So it just goes to prove that these, you know, unless you're actually really actively doing good inventory, you know, quite often there's going to be all sorts of machines that just sort of slip through the cracks, or the guy who is adminning this load balance is gone or whatever, and someone changes a firewall rule and all of a sudden it's on the internet. I mean, that's really the way it is in reality, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I have another funny case, what you mentioned, which happens to our company. We hosted a web server on a big hosting, international hosting company, and it was some kind of contract where you lease the hardware, and until certain years, 3 or 4 years, you own then the hardware, and you, if you like, you get it sent and can replace it by a new one. So they do not have the trouble with all this old hardware, because then it belongs to the customer. And we did this, and after 3 or 4 years, we requested that they should send us our web server, our old server we run there. And they were not able to find it. It was still up and running, and they were not able to find it in their own data center. That drove me somehow to the question, how do they do business? So how is internally their business organized if they are even not able to find our running web server to shut it down and to send us the hardware, including the hard disks?
Yeah,
and this is exactly the problem of these big names, big enterprises, big organizations. It is a lot of marketing, which is shiny to the customer, and a lot of fancy information, like exactly this CNET news article about the Sony CEO and its shareholder, that they all sit together and came to the conclusion that their brand was clearly improving again, which is just marketing, but under the hood, and which is not visible and not transparent. There are some open construction sites and a lot of things to do to really have a security solution installed which protects customer data and make sure that they do not leak.
So you honestly believe that the damage to Sony is probably a little bit more severe than they realize, or than they're saying?
Oh, I am completely sure about this. I am completely sure. And that's what I have read is that what we see right now and what they try to mitigate with marketing messages is just the how you call it, the tip of the iceberg. So you only see what is over the water, but under the water, which is still somehow clumsy and not really working and not fixed and so on, is much, much bigger. And it will maybe disappear, but maybe will not. But I cannot follow the idea that the brand already improved again. That therefore they didn't show anything what was improved. That if I were a customer from Sony, unfortunately I'm not a member of their online network community. But if I were, I would expect that they show some progress and they show something what they changed for future, and which convinced me besides marketing messages.
Marcus Hennig, thank you so much for taking some time. I know you've been very busy finalizing the Sophos acquisition of Astaro, Sophos' acquisition of Astaro. So thank you so much for taking the time out to have a chat to us here on Risky Business.
Thank you, Patrick. It was a great pleasure to talk to you and your podcast.
mga busa malaso sa mukda bala sa band mga sentin ba falaman usugi po sa sun ulogo sa masa mulo.
Marcus Hennig of our sponsor Astero there with a look at Sony's claims that its brand is recovering well in the wake of its security woes. We've got some more big dreams for you now. These guys are based out of Soweto, just outside of Johannesburg, and I've got no idea what this track is called, but it's really cool. So I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening.
Mga buga was spinning up, give them some genile, but for that, who's so cool? Then don't understand, pulling a flow with some meal, what this was a self-figure, and I'll go my son. The album with delay, 7 months is a kitchen, and my man just said, but you are a flow with put to gill and a sound that you to gill and my son just a figure, a spaggy or a drum. They look cool, cool and cool. Queen and join us, none is done, it looks so sleepy cool. Like him, Susan and a pool. Unga suga in Dunang is a club and jang a tuna. Never chit chimbo. Say a postal no good to the singles. So push a jang a veto. So if you're feeling this track, holla at your veto. The Gaspar Bisubani, which was no killing it. Say you're bumming this whole post. I lose a part of my pen again. Kimu rapper boss. Miss a drunner, they get better. Fully pepper boss. So kinda they get better. The Gaspar Bisubani, which was no killing it. Say you're bumming this whole post. I lose a part of my pen again. Kimu rapper boss. Miss a drunner, they get better. Fully pepper boss. So fucka legitimate. Let's go.